jams. Parker on the mixing board. Thank you for that. I'm Austin Cross, filling in for Larry Mantle this week on Air Talk, and it is so good to have you with us. I'm dancing a little bit in the studio. It's okay if you do too. Hey, next hour, we're going to be talking with mixologists about their favorite cocktails ahead of the holiday season, and we'll want to hear from you about what you're planning to make this New Year's. You know, I like to think about how the chapter that we're currently living is going to be written about in somebody's doctoral thesis in like 200 years, right? I'm a big history person. You might figure that one out at some point. And it really makes me think of the gin craze in England in the early 1700s. You can look that one up. It was this chapter when people were just really wild about gin. And so here I am thinking, you know, I'm sure a lot of people's alcohol tolerance is up this year. So maybe drinks of this generation will seem stronger to future generations. That's what I'm thinking about right now. I don't know what you think about that one, but that's actually a perfect segue to our next conversation because we're looking at the long-lasting impacts of the COVID-19 pandemic and how it's going to affect the generations coming out of this time. Now, you know, there is no doubt that 2020 has been a year for the history books, if we have books in the future, you know. Between COVID-19, George Floyd protests against racism and police brutality, the presidential election, which still seems like it's going on for some reason, it's been a time filled with pain, fear, and of course, a lot of uncertainty. And like many crises in American history, the events of this year will help define a generation, maybe a few of them. Now, in the 20th century, we had the greatest generation, right? And that was shaped by the Great Depression and World War II. And millennials, of course, we came of age with the events of 9/11 and the recession. It left a lot of impact on us. Well, generations of people are shaped by events that are not only economic, but social and emotional. And I think it's safe to say that the pandemic has ticked just about 1, 2, 3, you know, all of those boxes. But how will it shape our futures? Well, I'd love to hear from you. How do you think the pandemic will affect your future? If you have children, what do you anticipate that this event will mean for their lives? What qualities of this period do you expect will come to define a generation? I want to hear from you. The number is 866-893-5722. I'm really looking forward to what we hear back from people on this one. Please, 866-893-5722. Or you can comment on the AirTalk page, or you can tweet us at AirTalk. I want to welcome my first guest. That's Marina Gorbis, Executive Director of the Institute for the Future. And that's a nonprofit research and consulting organization based in Silicon Valley. Marina, thank you so much for joining us.
Hi, great to be with you.
So I understand that the Institute for the Future, which is a very cool name, by the way, is modeling different post-pandemic scenarios. And so I'm really curious. Can you tell me a bit about what kinds of research you do to develop these scenarios?
Sure. We're using something called alternative scenario methodology, which is basically based on the idea that, you know, the future is not something that is a given. There are a lot of things that we can do to shape the future in different directions. So it's looking at a whole range of different possibilities, from basically continuing on the same path as we were before, to radically changing our ideology and set of policies to move in a very different direction. The way we go about doing this scenario work is, first of all, we start with history, because it's essential when you think about the future to really understand historical patterns. How did we get to where we are? This is not the first time this humanity went through pandemics. We've lived through many of them, and there are certain patterns that they follow. So you start with understanding the future and these large patterns. But of course, you know, as you think about the future, there are these patterns, but they don't necessarily repeat themselves exactly in the same way as they were before. So one of my colleagues said, there are no facts about the future. You know, we have a lot of data and a lot of facts about the past, but there are no certainties about the future. So what we do a lot of is we look at signals. There's this famous phrase by science fiction writer William Gibson that the future is here, it's just not evenly distributed, meaning that there are signs and signals of the future all around us. And if you're trained to look at those signals and pick them up and say, why is this happening? What is this a signal of? What's a larger transformation? You start thinking about, well, what does it mean in the future? Where can it go? So it's a collection of a lot of different ways and of picking up signals, understanding history, talking to experts from different disciplines, talking to people on the ground in terms of what is their experience of this event, how are they dealing with that? And on that basis, you kind of have this framework to develop a whole set of different scenarios.
Wow, I imagine things can be really different, just given so many different factors in society. I know there were a number of plagues over human history that are well documented, and different things came out of those. Just like there were different world wars, of course, and things were different after each one of those world wars. So given your research, what scenarios appear to be the most likely to play out in the United States post-pandemic?
Well, there's multiple scenarios possible. One of them is basically continuing to the way we were before, which is that post-pandemic, as people get more and more people get vaccinated, we learn how to deal with this, with the virus better, things will start opening up and we'll continue on the path of growth. But the kind of growth we'll have is, again, very unequally distributed. And that's continuing from the past, that we're going to see tremendous wealth inequalities. Past the pandemic, we'll have a lot of people with high levels of debt. Returns of this economic sort of prosperity or boom that's post-pandemic will go to people who own capital equity, or they have, you know, financial assets, and that will continue. But people who are wage earners and your regular people will be highly disadvantaged economically. So that's not a particularly great scenario. The alternative scenario, which we call a transformation scenario, is that we really take lessons from this pandemic. And this pandemic is kind of a big event, but it's revealed a lot of things that have been happening for decades. You know, what we're experiencing today is a result of kind of choices and decisions that were made decades ago around how, you know, our tax structure, our kind of what we decide to invest in, what kind of infrastructure we build, what's happening with our public health infrastructure. Those are all choices we made decades ago, kind of disinvestment in public infrastructure. So the transformation scenario to us is moving to a very different kind of understanding of what is the cause of this. And it's moving kind of beyond what is called sort of neoliberalism. It's really understanding that we're actually all connected, and that when we raise one boat, we raise all the boats. So we call it sort of social solidarity or mutualism scenario. And it involves lots of different policy choices, different kinds of choices. It involves investment of public resources in infrastructure, including public health infrastructure, education infrastructure, roads, and all kinds of things that basically give these very valuable resources and give access to them to more and more people. So it's leading to greater equity as well as hopefully some growth.
I'm talking right now to Marina Gorbis. She's executive director of the Institute for the Future. And if you have questions or if you have comments about how you think this current generation will be changed in the future, if you have children, what do you anticipate this event might mean for their lives? Please give us a call, 866-893-5722. Again, that's 866-893-5722. Or you can comment on the AirTalk page. One thing that I noticed, Marina, as I was reading and kind of getting ready for this conversation, is somebody pointed out that even though an event happens in history, say, you know, this pandemic is happening, depending on the age of the person that it happens to, it might affect them differently as they grow older. And that's along with certain factors like education gaps and stuff like that, which we might actually see as a result of this pandemic. You know, kids just aren't getting the same education access that they were getting before. Just about a minute before we have to go to break, and then we're going to come back to this and dive even deeper. But I'm sure a lot of people are wondering right now, are the kids going to be okay?
I think the kids will be okay. I do think that this event, to me, these kind of transformational events are the kind of events where people start seeing the world in a different way. And I think what we're seeing now is not just kids, but all of us, we're having a different image of the U.S. and our country. And I would say, in summary, it's we've been diminished. We have a diminished view of this country, and we have a diminished view of our own prospects and possibilities, which, by the way, is not a bad thing.
You are listening to Air Talk. I'm speaking with Marina Gorbis. She's executive director of the Institute for the Future, and we're discussing what the generational impact of COVID-19 and what this pandemic might be. We want to hear from you. How do you expect that you will look back on this time? How do you think the pandemic will shape your future, the future of your children? We would love to hear your thoughts on that. 866-893-5722, 866-893-5722. You can tweet us at AirTalk. You can also comment on our Facebook page. When we come back from our break, just a couple minutes from now, we're going to bring in another guest for this conversation. It's Jane Hong, an associate professor of history at Occidental College. History is one of my favorite topics, and I truly believe that history gives us an idea of what we might expect in the future. We're going to hear her thoughts in just a minute. I'm Austin Cross, in for Larry Mantle on Air Talk. This is Air Talk. I'm Austin Cross, in for Larry Mantle, who is taking a much-needed break. We were talking about how the pandemic could shape the lives of future generations here in America, and we want to hear from you. What do you think? How do you think the pandemic will shape your future, or maybe even the future of your kids? We're at 866-893-5722 again, 866-893-5722. I would love to hear your thoughts. You can also tweet us at AirTalk or leave a comment on our Facebook page. I want to bring in another guest for this conversation. It's Jane Hong, and she's an associate professor of history at Occidental College. Professor Hong, thank you so much for joining us today.
Hi, Austin. It's great to be here.
Well, Professor, we have seen a lot of people compare the COVID-19 pandemic to the 1918 Spanish flu. I've seen it come up a lot. And of course, that is another 100-year disease event. But are there other parallels that we see between these two periods?
Well, I think that's a great question, and it might be helpful just to get a sense of what the 1918 flu pandemic looked like.
Sure.
So the 1918 pandemic, it lasted about 2 years, and it killed about 675,000 Americans out of a global total of 50 to 100 million. So much bigger in scale. It killed many healthy young people. So interestingly, many U.S. soldiers fighting in World War I, which was raging at the time. More U.S. soldiers actually died from the 1918 flu than actually were killed in battle during the war.
Wow.
And the flu spread, it spread everywhere. And it affected people of all racial backgrounds, economic backgrounds. The U.S. president at the time, Woodrow Wilson, also reportedly contracted it. So that's, I guess, one historical parallel that we can point out. The COVID-19 pandemic, I mean, we're nearly a year in. It's killed about 350,000 Americans out of a global total of about 1.7 million deaths. We've seen that it disproportionately kills the elderly, the immunocompromised, although young people have also had, you know, serious long-term health deficiencies and also have died as a result. And we've also seen that COVID-19, you know, due to a long history of racialized health and economic disparities, we've seen it disproportionately killed Black and brown people at a rate of 3 to 1. So there are some similarities, but there are also lots of differences. In terms of, I guess, parallels, one thing that hasn't really changed in the United States, unfortunately, is in many ways the decentralized response that we've seen to managing the virus. So in 1918 to 1920, you know, Americans in different cities, different places were ordered to wear masks, schools, theaters, businesses were shuttered. The New York City subway, for example, had restrictions. But in ways that are really eerily similar to now, these efforts were highly decentralized. They varied dramatically from place to place in ways that hampered containment efforts and, you know, arguably led to unnecessary deaths. And I think that you see similar kinds of parallels today. There were also, I mean, there were anti-maskers in 1918. I've seen a number of news articles about this. There's examples like the Anti-Mask League of San Francisco, but there were far fewer of these. Since wearing a mask in 1918 actually became for many an act of wartime patriotism, so a way to support the Allies fighting in World War One. And the final thing I'll say is one thing that's very different about the two pandemics that I think is really important for us to remember is the medical science. And on this front, you know, rather than comparing the two pandemics, it's probably more accurate to see the 1918 flu pandemic as helping create the national and international infrastructures that have made it possible for the U.S. and other countries to develop vaccines today in such a short time. In 1918, there were no reliable diagnostic tests, no vaccines, no antiviral drugs. Many medical professionals they weren't very familiar with the idea of a virus, and many Americans didn't have reliable access to healthcare. So there was no centralized federal U.S. agency like the CDC of Anthony Fauci fame. And, you know, it's actually in large part because of the 1918 flu pandemic that nations like the U.S. took steps to consolidate and expand healthcare. And also the 1918 flu pandemic led to the first international organizations designed to fight epidemics, like the WHO, for example. And so, you know, in many ways, the speed, the effectiveness of our scientists and medical professionals today, you know, we owe a debt to the lessons that we learned in 1918.
I'm talking right now with Jane Hong, an associate professor of history at Occidental College. And that actually encourages me a little bit, Professor Hong. And I'll tell you why, because as a history person, I love to see how we got here, how we learn from our past mistakes, and we made things better in the future and especially saved lives in the future. But I also have this sort of dread, if you spend any amount of time on Twitter, that there's a large portion of the country that has extremely misguided beliefs still about not only this virus and this pandemic, but and how we got here and how it spread and the importance of containing it. And I'm wondering, how confident are you in the future that history will record this moment accurately enough that we'll learn from the mistakes that we made today?
That is the question I think that many historians have been asking ourselves. We do this work. We meticulously study and research the past. And I think for myself and for many historians that I know, the hope really is that, you know, the work that we do in writing about racial disparities, mistakes that we've made, state failures, right, would encourage people to think differently in the future. I mean, I think in terms of the medical science, I mean, you know, we owe such a great debt to scientists, frontline medical professionals who are still working so hard, even though they are being attacked on Twitter. There are state officials, as all of us, or many of us know, if you've been following the news, you know, health officials who are trying to protect the public are getting death threats, are getting harassed, kind of picketers and protesters on their lawns. I mean, so I think the scientific community, to their great credit, has been kind of steadily marching on. They've been doing their work. They've been learning from the past. They have been building on the science, the scientific expertise and knowledge that has accumulated over these past many years. In terms of, you know, the misinformation, the disinformation, the Twitter wars, the anti-maskers, I mean, I have a daughter, and so I have to have some hope that, you know, whether it be just people who have some kind of influence or power would draw lessons from the past and would try not to repeat the mistakes of the present in future pandemics. I mean, the thing that I find really interesting is in reading about historians writing about the 1918 pandemic, several of them have noted that people seem to forget about it pretty soon after it happened. So the argument is it got lost in the crush of World War I's aftermath and the Great Depression. I mean, I don't really see that happening with this pandemic in the same way. I could be wrong, but I don't think people will really easily or soon forget their year of being inside in quarantine and you know, the mask debates. And so I do have great hope that, you know, in terms of, even if it's not individual Americans necessarily, that state officials, state agencies will learn lessons from this pandemic and will take steps to ensure that in the future there's better diagnostic testing, that there is contact tracing, that there are things the state can do to suppress misinformation about public health issues. And so I do have hope for that. I'm a historian, so I study the past. But again, the hope really is, as you mentioned earlier, the hope is that studying the past will help us to improve or to kind of not make the same mistakes in the future.
I think that your hope gives me hope. Thank you so much for that very thought-out answer. We also were speaking to this segment with Marina Gorbis, Executive Director of the Institute for the Future. And I know I could talk about this forever, but sadly, we must break. But I want to thank both of you for coming on, Marina Gorbis, as well as Professor Hong at Occidental. I'm Austin Cross, in for Larry Mantle. Air Talk continues next hour. Stay with us.